From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in 1850 with the founding of the University of Rochester. Of course, it was not then the massive regional employer that it is today, and it was 70 years before many of the momentous changes that have shaped the last century here in the city of Rochester, here in our region, and certainly for the university. A new book tells the story. It's called Our Work Is But Begun, a tour of history with tremendous documents and photographs, with an eye on where the university has been and stands today. We'll welcome our guest, and then I get to welcome a colleague as well. But first, let me welcome the guests who are in studio with us and on the phone. Paul Burgett is here. Paul is the university vice president who happened to write the books afterward. Paul, nice to see you.
I did. Thank you, Evan. Glad to be here.
Nice to have you. Melissa Mead is here, Rochester Collections librarian, who certainly participated in a lot of the research, which must have been great fun for this book.
It was. Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
And Janet Petersy is on the line with us. Janice is the author of the book that is beautiful. Janice, thank you for taking the time to get on the line with us, and great work on the book.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Evan.
But before we jump into the conversation, I also have to welcome my colleague Helen B. and Duty Hofer, because a little something going on this
week. That's right, a little something. We've got our fall pledge drive taking place right now, and always like to start off by thanking those of you who have already taken the time to pledge your support. We have volunteers are standing by, 454-6300. That's the number to call. And I think, Evan, during pledge drive, this is the time when we think about, you know, why do we listen to public radio, and what do we value about public radio? What's important for us? What are those programs that we tune into, whether we listen with our colleagues, whether we listen with our families, whether we listen with our friends? And then we think about the kind of conversations that take place based on what we hear on programs like this and like Connections, and based on the conversation that you will hear in just a few moments. And so they just place a value on that. And when you do make that pledge of support, programs like this, they continue to operate. And Evan is able to bring on fascinating guests and discuss things with in depth and with varied perspectives. And those are the things that that you love about this program. That's why you tune in every day. And that's why we ask that at this time, you would just make that pledge of support. Again, the number is 454-6300. We also make it extremely easy online. You can just go to WXXI.org.
And we are not at all like 1904 Rush Reese was with George Eastman. I just want to tell you, it's a very different scenario now.
That's right.
Because, Helen, can I tell you a quick story?
Please do.
Sometimes in the world of universities, higher education, look, they need people to help them. And
right.
Here was George Eastman.
Right.
And, of course, a lot of people were hoping that he would help them out.
Right.
And they came, and Rush Reese told him, I think, I'm trying to remember, said they needed $150,000. And George Eastman said, well, I can give you 10.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was a bit of a back and forth. And I love this story because, let's just say, the pledge increased. And that was the first of a great relationship. And, of course, now Eastman School of Music.
Exactly.
There's many ways. So what we're talking about pledges, we're a little more softer-handed than Rush Reese was, I think. That's all I'm...
Evan, I'll tell you that building, that $10,000, which then was enhanced by another $65,000 from Mr. Eastman, that building still stands.
Mm-hmm.
It's on the old Prince Street campus, and it's a red brick building, and wonderful to look at.
Very good.
It was our biology.
So see what
standing.
You can do?
That's right.
See
that's
what
right.
you can do?
Exactly.
Thank you, Helen.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for popping in here. And let me say, Janice, I loved that story and so many others. And I started there because it's so easy to go to where George Eastman was. But where, in your mind, what is the most enjoyable story that you love that came out of this book that most people had never heard before?
Oh, my.
I know. I'm putting you on the spot.
I have to think about that for a minute. Most enjoyable story. Oh, my gosh. Evan, I don't know where to go. I guess I would say that I was most surprised to learn about all of the things that happened during World War II
mm-hmm.
at the U of R. And I'm trying to think about what I enjoyed the most. There were lots of little anecdotes that were very enjoyable, so I'm not sure I could pinpoint it.
Well, and let me also say, that's where I think this book is so beautiful, in that the images are beautiful,
mm-hmm.
but you could have sort of given a broad overview of Eastman's relationship, of Rush Reese, of what happened during World War II, but instead you really dug in, and my guess is that Melissa Mead and others really helped you do that, and we're going to find out as we go throughout the hour here. But
mm-hmm.
Can I just read that section that I talk about? I love the flavor that comes with this description, because you write here that the story of Eastman's first major gift in 1904, when Reese looked for a donation for a physics and biology building, President and Mrs. Reese visited Eastman to tell him that $150,000 was needed to build it and equip the laboratory. And then you quote, Eastman offered $10,000. As the Reeses were leaving, Eastman called them back. You're disappointed, aren't you? He asked. What did you expect? I had hoped, Reese replied, that you might give the whole building. Well, I'll think it over, said Eastman, and then the next morning a check for $60,000 to cover the cost of construction appeared on Reese's desk because, as Eastman told Walter Hubbell, Dr. Reese let me alone. Years later, Eastman would boast, Dr. Reese never asked me for a cent. Rush Reese's report of the incident to the trustees read, quote, Mr. Eastman, entirely on his own initiative, without any solicitation, either direct or indirect on my part, increased his pledge to $60,000. Now, I'm not sure if that was embellished a little bit, but what a great story. And that kind of interaction lets you see a little into the world at that time. And I guess I just wanted to say thanks for taking the time to dig up stories like that for this book.
Thanks, Evan. You know, the Eastman-Reese relationship was intriguing to me. And early on in the project, I was very interested in trying to get to the bottom of how that developed. There is not a lot of documentation on paper. They weren't communicating personally, really. And they clearly stayed, they were cut in some ways from the same cloth as far as being reserved, very careful, formal. I think that I read in Elizabeth Breyer's biography of George Eastman that it was 25 years before they addressed each other by first names. They both were very focused on the very best in whatever they took on. They had a lot in common in those ways. And I think President Reese was very careful with George Eastman. I think he went to him with requests in a certain way that didn't come across as at all pushy. And Eastman responded very well to that.
Yeah, because he had asked for 150. Eastman gives 60, and then Reese has the deft touch to write him back and essentially say, thank you so much. Now, we still need to get to 150, so do you think I ought to wait for other people to pitch in, or where do you think we stand as a way to go wink, wink? And how brilliant was that move? And they end up having this very interesting and certainly mutual, I would say, just from reading, mutual respect, I think, is fair to say. Right, Janice?
Absolutely.
Yeah, so there you go. What a great story. But let's go back to the beginning, if we could, because we only have Janice for the half hour. And 1850, set the scene for us on the founding. I mean, for the people especially who know University of Rochester today, 1850 was a different world here. Tell me a little bit about the broad outline of the founding and the early mission.
Actually, Paul's a great storyteller on this section. I'd be happy to do it, but he has lived this and told this story many times, so maybe for a moment I'll defer to Paul.
He just broke into a huge smile. He's gearing up here. Go ahead, Paul.
Once upon a time.
He also has the best voice for radio in this building, so go right ahead.
In the mid-19th century, in the 1840s, as a matter of fact, in Hamilton, New York, there was a college by the name of Madison University, and there was great turmoil amongst some of the trustees, students, and faculty about the appropriateness of the growth of Madison University in this very small town. The United States was moving out of its rural and agrarian past into its urban and industrial future. So people like John Wilder and Azahel Kendrick and John Richardson were arguing that Madison University should move to Rochester. Well, acrimonious quarreling broke out. It made its way all the way to the New York State Supreme Court. And on the basis of a very, very odd technicality, the judge ruled that Madison could remain in Hamilton, New York. But our pioneers, led by John Wilder, moved to Rochester anyway and set up school in 1850 on West Main Street. Now, I should say that Madison University didn't do too badly because, in fact, it is now, and in 1896, it changed its name to Colgate. So the University of Rochester is, in fact, born of the rib of Colgate University. We set up school in 1850 in the United States Hotel, a building which still stands on West Main Street, just a stone's throw from Nick Tahoe's. And as I like to say to students, our early founders must have understood the importance of tradition to students because students still frequent Nick Tahoe's on a regular basis.
So there you are. So but I love that imagery, born of the rib of Colgate University. Still, in many ways, it had to kind of go through different iterations and moving around. And Janice, for someone like you, when you take on a project like this, when we've talked to other authors on, say, researching a book about William Henry Seward or other subjects, remarkable resources here when it comes to letters and preservation of history. When you're going back to inside the University of Rochester, what did you find when it comes to what was available?
Oh, my, Evan, it was a terrific, just a tremendous trove of information and very well organized. I relied heavily on the papers of each president and the minutes of the Board of Trustees. And, there were just, I was taken on a tour to the back room at one point, and it's hard to describe just how many boxes and boxes of materials there are.
But isn't that daunting?
It is. It is daunting. And for the most part, I was able to look at indexes of what the papers were and sort of, you know, my background is as a journalist, so in a way it was almost like interviewing documents and figuring out, okay, which files are most likely to have what I might need. And the library staff was just terrific. If I wasn't finding something here, you know, quickly finding a different box for me, different files for me. Spent a lot of time over there, and it was just fascinating.
When it comes to the growth, Janice, you know, let me also back up and say you've divided the book into sort of, I want to say, eight sections. I'm trying to think of it, remember exactly how you divided the book, but why did you choose to do it the way you did?
Well, I thought about a few different approaches at the get-go and decided it made the most sense to try to look at it according to each presidential administration. Each one of these leaders came in with a different set of circumstances, different goals, if you will, and different environments, you know, within the national higher education trends and within the economies of their times. So I decided to go that route, and it seemed to work pretty well.
I'm looking for, I can't find it, but you did such a wonderful job of here it is, finding some older images, and here it is on page 44, one of my favorite of the book. The concept of building for the future was embodied in the slogan, A Greater University for a Greater Rochester, and you write, this idealized rendering of a campus set against the Genesee was used on a campaign brochure in 1924. Though it looks more like it's in the Mediterranean Sea, this picture. This is, I don't remember Rochester looking quite like this. but there, it's a great image. And again, you must have had so many different ones you could choose from.
It's beautiful. And I'll say, I was involved there were a few people involved in selecting images. The library staff pulled all of these, you know, Melissa pulled a ton of those. In fact, I think Melissa wrote that caption. And, you know, tons of things were pulled and reviewed. We really wanted, as much as possible, to use images that had not been used in previous publications by the U of R.
Melissa, I've seen great pictures from the country of Greece, and this picture looks like Rochester straight out of the Mediterranean. It's beautiful.
That picture was used as a letterhead on essentially a fundraising brochure. And one of the people involved in raising funds in 1924, they wanted these beautiful renderings because they wanted things that would essentially, the phrase was to draw blood from a turnip.
uh, I will say nothing further about that. The book is called Our Work Has But Begun, A History of the University of Rochester, 1850 to 2005. And Janice Bullard Peters is on the line with us. She took on the project with great help from many people, Paul and Melissa in studio. And we're going to talk more about their roles as we go throughout the hour here. You also had to make the decision in some regards to the huge figure that is George Eastman, because in many ways people have been writing about him and his life for a good number of years, but he is so vital to this, to the growth of the university, the relationship with Rush Rhys, that, you know, how did you decide what was the appropriate level of coverage you wanted to give there?
Well, he's clearly just phenomenally important to the development of the University of Rochester. At the same time, that I felt that that was one piece that, even if people didn't know it closely, people were probably familiar with it. So in some ways, that was the most difficult chapter to write, to write something that's been done many times. So I don't know, in your read of it, I hope it doesn't seem as if he is at all minimized.
Not at all. And in fact, that's why I wanted to sort of zero in and start there, because I loved the color that you added, from whether you're reading from letters and going back to what Rush Rhys was writing at the time. And no, for me it was, you know, I'm not a historian on the University of Rochester, but it was fabulously interesting, and I thought you did a wonderful job with that.
And thank you.
Paul, how do you feel about why don't you jump in and sort of give your overview, by the way, of that section before we start moving towards the modern years?
Well, the relationship between George Eastman and Rush Rhys cannot be overstated. Janice made the comment that it wasn't until 1925 that they began to address each other by their first names. As a matter of fact, they met in 1900 or so, in 1904, when George Eastman, when Rush Rhys actually made the ask for the physics and biology building, which you've already pointed out. I have reviewed the correspondence between George Eastman and Rush Rhys over that period of time. And it's very interesting because the letters all start one to the other as Dr. Rhys, mm-hmm. when it comes from George Eastman, and Mr. Eastman. Well, in 1920, there's a letter from George Eastman to between the two men, in which George Eastman addresses Dr. Rhys as Dr. Rush. So in his response, President Rhys says to Mr. Eastman, he answers whatever questions Mr. Eastman is bringing up, and he ends his letter by saying, I couldn't help but be, but notice your salutation, Dr. Rush. And he said, my only suggestion would be that perhaps you would drop the doctor. That was his way of saying that could we not go on a first name basis. This was in 1920. The next letter from Mr. Eastman to President Rhys began, Dear Dr. Rush. Dear Dr. Rhys. He was not ready to go on a first name basis. But in 1925, and I think it's fair to say we cannot overstate the significance of the decade of the 20s. In 1925, the Eastman School had been founded. The School of Medicine and Dentistry and Strong Memorial Hospital had been invented. We had acquired the River Campus. And in 1925, all of a sudden, their correspondence, their salutations changed to Dear George and Dear Rush. So that decade of the 20s, before we get into the modern era, the decade of the 20s cannot be overstated, and it is a function of the relationship between George Eastman and Rush Rhys, in my view, the creation of our first two professional schools, and in 1919, when the New York State Department of Education granted approved the creation of the Eastman School of Music, the University of Rochester became a university in fact as well as in name. But also, our first PhD was awarded in 1925. The Institute of Optics was established in 1929. And in 1930, the College for Men moved from the Prince Street campus to the River campus. It was an astonishing accomplishment over this slightly longer than a decade period of time. Very, very important, and establish the University of Rochester as the great research university, the nucleus foundation of a great research university.
It's been nearly 90 years since the mid-1920s, and for me, that is the start of the modern era, for all of the reasons that Paul just said. Before we get back to Janice, because she only has a few more minutes, I want to take a call. And is this Simon? Simeon.
Simeon,
thanks for calling, sir. You're on Connections. Thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Sure. You're welcome. Thanks for taking my call. Since the conversation seems to be linking together Dr. Rush Rees and George Eastman, I'm wondering if in the course of your research and in your book you came across or dealt with a connective tissue that linked the two of them, which was anti-Semitism. George Eastman was known for refusing to hire Jews, Kodak, and for promoting them. He had very restrictive policies in that regard. Rush Rees, my grandfather, was admitted to the University of Rochester in 1913 and was an Orthodox Jew, had a problem because he was required to attend classes on Saturday, which was a violation of his religious tradition. He went to see Dr. Rees about that, and the response was, well, if you can't attend Saturday classes, you have no business being at the University of Rochester. I know that doesn't define the totality of this great institution, and I'm not at all suggesting that it's like that today, but I think if you look at history, you have to sort of be willing to deal with those things to get a complete and honest perspective, and I'm wondering if you came across anything like that.
Simeon, I did not.
Simeon, thanks for the call, but Janice, again, that's not something that came up in your research.
It didn't. Paul, is it ringing a bell with you?
Only anecdotally. Mm-hmm. I have heard whispers of this particular kind of discrimination, but I think I would turn to Melissa to ask Melissa if she has any knowledge of it, because she has such intimate and close association with the documents.
Mm-hmm. And I would say that I haven't come across it either. But I've had other people who've asked the same question, yeah. So I'm always on the lookout to see. I'm not sure it's the kind of thing that you would actually find in the papers, that someone would commit that to paper. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's probably difficult to document it, and so we kind of have to rely, I think, on anecdotal evidence, as Simeon has kindly provided us in this conversation. It's very helpful and very important for us to hear that.
Look, in many ways, hagiography doesn't do anybody any good, because that's not real life. I mean, George Eastman was not a perfect man, but he was a hugely important man and did so many wonderful, great things. And Paul, you were going to jump in there?
Yeah, I was going to say what a lot of people don't know about George Eastman, for example. He's the great philanthropist, but many people don't know that while his contributions to the University of Rochester were enormous, he's the largest individual donor that in the university's history, he was also a donor to historically black colleges and universities. And in fact, the Tuskegee Institute and the Hampton Institute, now Tuskegee University and Hampton University, benefited enormously from his largesse to the tune of about $2 million. I think that's the number, $2 million each in those to their endowments. And that was back in the early part of the century that he did that. And he was friends with Booker T. Washington, or an associate of Booker T. Washington. So it's important to understand the times as well, even though there are, on the basis of anecdotal messages that we're hearing, there are troubling aspects of the treatment or the exclusion of people.
Janice, I've got to let you go in a minute here, but let me, only because you mentioned that some of your favorite stuff is the fact that people might not realize that during World War II, you of our researchers played an important role, and give me a quick slice of that.
Okay. Well, one of the people who stood out, there were a number of faculty from Rochester, and this would be true at universities across the country. It was the World War II was such a massive effort for the entire nation. Lee Dubridge, the physics chairman, was appointed the founding director of the radiation laboratory at MIT, where most of the radar was, you know, enhanced and developed for World War II purposes. Lee Dubridge later served as the president of California Institute of Technology and the science advisor to Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Nixon. Albert Noyes, the chemistry chairman during World War II, was in charge of the National Chemical Warfare Research. There wasn't much chemical warfare used at the time, and this division, they knew that there were some capabilities with Italy, Germany, I'm not sure what other countries. But this division was focused mostly on the development of effective gas masks. Stafford Warren, who was a pioneer in nuclear medicine and was here at Rochester, became the director of the medical division for the Manhattan Project. He was overseeing efforts to understand the impact of radiation on people. Those were a few of the more interesting people, but overall, the faculty involvement at Rochester, I think it stretched through just about every department. And I think it's worth saying that this era in general was a real turning point in our nation's appreciation for the capabilities and potential for increased knowledge from our research universities. It was, you know, during and after the war that you saw a lot more federal funding coming to these schools for research purposes.
Janice, thanks for taking the time. Again, the book is Our Work Is But Begun, and we're going to continue the discussion with our guests in studio. But Janice Bullard-Petersy is the author. The book's out now. It's a history of the University of Rochester. And thank you for sharing your perspective on putting the book together with us, Janice. We appreciate that. We lost Janice. Oh, we've lost Janice. Thank you, Janice. So let's do this. Let's take a 60-second break. Let's come back. I want to go back to the 1920s and get our guest perspective then on, you know, obviously big gifts from George Eastman helped propel the school, not only in the School of Music, but the School of Medicine and Dentistry, but that's a gift of money. You have to have the quality and the growth of what was Strong Hospital, a medical school that is now really rivaled around the world. So let's start there as we look ahead towards the rest of the history of the University of Rochester. The book, Our Work Is But Begun, and our conversation continues next on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Wednesday on the next Connections, Blame the Parents. We explore the question of what parents can do to get more involved in their children's education. In the city of Rochester in particular, parental involvement is vital, and we'll explore volunteer opportunities. And second hour, Senator Ted O'Brien joins us to talk about the conclusion of what's been a tough campaign. It's coming up Wednesday on Connections.
Popularity is this bloody little cousin of prestige, my friend.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Edward Norton about co-starring in the new film Birdman as a gifted but pretentious and self-absorbed actor. Norton's other films include Moonrise Kingdom, The Grand Budapest Hotel, The 25th Hour, and Fight Club. Join us.
Tonight at 7.
Welcome back to Connections. Paul, where do people find the book, Our Work Is But Begun?
Well, the book is on sale at Barnes & Noble, and which has just opened up in College Town at the corner of Mount Hope and Elmwood Avenue. And I turned to Val to ask if she is aware of any other sources.
No, she's saying...
So Barnes & Noble, Barnes & Noble, go to Barnes & Noble. And I'm sure if you go to Barnes & Noble online, you likely can, hopefully you can find it there as well. You can get it. You can get it at the Barnes & Noble at the corner of the brand new Barnes & Noble that's part of College Town at Mount Hope and Elmwood Avenue.
We're gonna look at more of the big picture stuff that really created the university and what it is today. But... you know, we could also talk about the fun stuff, like should you have to wear a coat and tie at dinner like they did in the 1950s? And, you know, a different world now. I love those little anecdotes that the book is filled with. Our guests for the remainder of the hour, Paul Burgett is the university vice president who wrote the books afterward. Melissa Mead is the Rochester Collections librarian who certainly helped with some of the research and even some of the writing we're finding out. Did you write the section on the 1951 vote on whether, was it 51? I'm trying to remember. When they voted on whether they had to wear... a coat and tie at dinner. The guys. I mean, I
did not, but oh. I did locate the photograph, which was going
I love
to
that
be
photo.
Pretty much contemporary to that. To that event.
That photo does look like you know, like you're going back in time, but I love the fact that not only did they vote on it, but there was a debate in the school newspaper, and the question was, what's the benefit of looking good at dinner? And I just love all of those are the little detail work that comes out of Our Work Has But Begun. The book is out now. But going back to the 1920s, it's one thing to get a big gift. It's another to create the foundation for a world-class research and medical enterprise. So, Paul, let me start there. When you look at the foundation, why did it grow into what it is today? There are plenty of research foundations. There are plenty of medical schools out there. What is the difference here?
I think that George Eastman, who himself was not an educated man, he dropped out of high school. He was from Waterville, New York. He eventually made his way to Rochester and had to go to work and did a number of jobs, including working in a bank, to help support his family. So I don't think he really understood the connection between business and higher education right away. But I think that when Rush Reese became our third president in 1900 and in fact served a term of 35 years, unheard of by today's standards, President Reese recognized that his relationship with this major industrialist, and George Eastman was certainly a major industrialist in the United States, that the growth of the university depended upon the relationship that he built with George Eastman. And thus, that first gift that we talked about at the top of the hour, which resulted in the creation of our physics and biology building. In 1918, George Eastman asked President Reese how he would like to have a music school, and President Reese wasn't so sure about that because he wasn't sure the resources would be there. But Mr. Eastman bought a music school that already existed on Prince Street at 47 Prince Street. It was called the DKG Institute of Musical Art, which subsequently became the Eastman School of Music. He bought it lock, stock, and barrel and turned it over to the university for a dollar, and we graduated our first two graduates in 1921. At that point, the relationship of respect and Mr. Eastman's recognition that the symbiotic relationship between between industry and higher education, and that's where he was going to get his knowledge. There's an interesting story that the famous 1924 campaign, which was the largest capital campaign in the university's history to that point. He had been soliciting subscriptions and resources for this, and one of his business colleagues wrote to him and said, "Now, George, you and I both know that we don't go after college men. We go after men of the hand, not men of the mind." And George Eastman wrote back to him and said, "I disagree. I used to think that way, but I don't think that way anymore because the future really is in the production of knowledge." And so this relationship with George Eastman was between George Eastman and Rush Reese was absolutely essential to the creation of the modern University of Rochester as we know it today. And the Eastman School of Music, founded in 1921, the School of Medicine and Dentistry 1924-25, as I mentioned, and our first PhD was in biochemistry in 1925, our second and third in 1927, one of whom, Vincent Duvigneau, won the Nobel Prize in Chemistry. At that point, the university was establishing itself as a major player. This was Yankee Stadium in higher education. In 1929, as I mentioned earlier, the Institute of Optics. Meanwhile, the River Campus, which now houses much of the university, had been Oak Hill Country Club. But in 1920, through a series of very complex real estate negotiations, Oak Hill moved out to its current location in Pittsford. And this is just astonishing to me, between 1927 and 1930, that campus was built. It's just astonishing that kind of progress took place. Because you see, before 27, the School of Medicine and Dentistry and Strong Memorial Hospital were being built. By the way, the creation of Strong Memorial Hospital is noteworthy because the city's municipal hospital was already at that location. And the city's medical director, a man by the name of George Goller, came to the university authorities and said, "You know, we've been thinking of moving the municipal hospital to another location, but since Strong Memorial Hospital is going to be built, why don't we join forces and have the municipal hospital and Strong Memorial Hospital join forces and share expenses and clinical support?" That is exactly what happened. So that decade was astonishing. And then in 1930, the College for Men was moved to this new river campus to be close to the Medical Center and the Natural Sciences. George Eastman's wealth, and Melissa can talk about that, because his wealth cannot be overstated, and his generosity cannot be overstated. Maybe Melissa would like to say a little bit about the gifts that George Eastman made.
I think Paul has covered a lot of them in terms of the Eastman School endowment, and which was part actually of his final gift in his will, which included endowments not only for the Eastman School specifically, but for the upkeep of his home. So the George Eastman House, part of which, as we know it, then became the President's House, and he left some money for upkeep of the house, so it wouldn't be a burden on the university. I think that George Eastman, although he gave so much money, also didn't want to be identified as the sole source of money for the university. So that 1924 campaign, the theme of it is a greater university for greater Rochester, which they had over 13,000 people give money to that campaign, which Paul noted was so large. It was a $10 million campaign, and they tried to raise it in 10 days. And they canvassed throughout the city, and they had teams going out. We have in the library a calligraphy book which commemorates the names of everyone who gave. So it's 13,400 and plus signatures. And George Eastman's name, it goes alphabetically. George Eastman's name is on the E page, and it's a double column of names. And there's nothing special about how his name is presented. And it's right opposite Eddie's Chop House.
What a fabulous story.
And so I don't know how much Eddie's Chop House gave. It could have been $5. It could have been $50. But it's sitting there right opposite George Eastman's name.
Before I get back to the phones, where is Eddie's Chop House today?
It's gone. Eddie's Chop House used to be on Main Street, which is now the location of the Law Library that's near the Eastman School. That Law Library that's there now, that's where Eddie's Chop House
was. And isn't it a credit to George Eastman, though, for him to... As Paul says, was not a man of education, for him to then choose to value and champion it.
Well, there's one final story that I'll tell, and that is that while after he gave the initial gift for the biology physics building in 1904, and said I gave it to President Reese because he didn't bother me for it, but I want you to know this is my first and last gift to the University
of
Rochester.
Yes, famous last words.
Yes. Because before he died in 1932, he died in March of 1932, but before he died, he called his attorneys to the mansion on East Avenue, and he added a codicil to his will, and leaving the balance of his estate, with the exception of a few special directives to some family members, he left the balance of his estate, which at that point, as I understand it, was about $17 million to the University of Rochester. In aggregate, according to our historian Arthur May, George Eastman's gifts to the University of Rochester in 1932 dollars totaled $51 million, making him one of the most generous donors to higher education, individual donors to higher education in American higher education history.
Remarkable. David in Rochester. David, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Yes, thank you. What a great program. Very timely for me because I just got back from a noon concert at Christ Church, which featured the University of Rochester Eastman School of Music, Craig Head Saunders Organ. And it was a massively wonderful experience. But my story is that I live right off Prince. And when I moved in here, I was walking around the backyard, so to speak, of the Memorial Art Gallery and saw these walkways back there that I thought were very strange and why they were there. And so I actually researched it somehow. And I come to find out, to me, which was a whole new discovery, which you just talked about, but I discovered that that's the old campus, and that's where the students walked around. I believe you can verify it. That's where the students walked around, and the red building over here was the chemistry building. It has an Eastman date on it. And the women's dorm was the is the School of the Arts, if I'm not mistaken, because I went and just looked up some of your archives, and so I'm walking around that old campus, and it's just a huge delight. I just wanted to share that.
Good for you. You're a great student. I am really impressed. Now, the building that has the name Eastman over it, that's the Physics and Biology building from 1904 that continues to stand. The Chemistry building was the Reynolds Laboratory. It no longer stands. But that very large building with, Melissa, what is the stone?
Medina Stone.
Medina Stone. That was our first building. It was Anderson Hall, named for our first president, Martin Brewer Anderson, and it is now the corporate headquarters for the United Way.
For the United Way.
And Melissa can say something maybe about the walkways.
I'm not sure I can. Yeah. But walkways.
I looked that up. The reason I figured that out was because there's an aerial shot done around the 50s of campus.
Yeah.
And those walkways match the walkways from that photo.
Well, it's, you know, there's so much, even though many of the buildings were torn down in 1968, the university left that area except for Memorial Art Gallery and Cutler Union. In 1955, the campuses merged and the women came over to the River Campus. But there's so much really which is still there in a way, so that when the sculpture park was going in, I got a phone call from someone who was doing the construction on the job saying that they'd been digging down and they were finding all of this tile, and what the heck was it? And how much were they going to find and have to clear out? And in fact, what they'd hit was the remains of the alumni gymnasium, which was on that campus from 1900 until 1930, when Cutler Union went in, and so they took down the gymnasium to put up Cutler Union. So there's pieces of it all over, ground and underneath.
And what you should know also is that, do you know where the Visual Studies Workshop is at the corner of University and Prince?
Yes, I do.
That, mm-hmm. Those were the first two buildings of the College for Women that was built in 1914. You see, when women were admitted in 1900, it was in a coeducational arrangement. But the idea of coeducation didn't exist with any great enthusiasm. The idea of the coordinate college, just so Hobart Williams Smith, Harvard, Radcliffe, et cetera. But the University of Rochester trustees in 1912 adopted a resolution creating a separate college for men and college for women. And in 1914, those buildings that housed the Visual Studies Workshop were constructed as the buildings for the College for Women. And then directly across the street in the dorms, 1925, those dorms were the Eastman dormitories. They were built in 1925.
David, thanks for the call. I appreciate that. Before we get back to our next call, let me also say that the book, we've been focusing on some of the great fun history, but the book really takes us into the modern era right up to 2005. And what I really appreciated about what Janice and what certainly our panelists in this room did was look at some of the modern grappling that a University of Rochester can have when it comes to focus on research, focus on practical application, focus on students and academics, all the things that have been in play for 100 years with research universities. I got the sense that President Jackson had grappled with as well. And I think those are important questions, Paul. And in many ways, that's part of the problem of success, is figuring out, you know, emphasis on research, emphasis on application, and making sure academic quality and all of those things. And that probably continues today.
Absolutely. I mean, Tom Jackson succeeded Dennis O'Brien. Tom came as our ninth president and served an 11-year period of time. And during those 11 years, his focus was on the College of Arts and Sciences and Engineering. Engineering was merged with Arts and Science at that point. And on the medical center, because Tom recognized back when he came as president that there were transformative, almost revolutionary developments in American healthcare that was on the horizon. And so he needed to pay a lot of attention to positioning the university to be prepared to meet those non-trivial challenges for healthcare, and also in the case of the residential college, the concept of the liberal arts residential college, positioning positioning ourselves in a way that made us as competitive as we are with respect not only to the academic program, the historical academic program, the classical education, but I can tell you that in the last few years, we have added about 14 new undergraduate majors to contemporize the academic program and also to coordinate more perfectly the in-class and out-of-class life of the undergraduate students. So Tom's tenure really focused on doing that, and I was here as a member of his presidential staff, and so was an observer on the scene of that. And it was terribly important, leaving for Joel Seligman, our 10th president, the enormous challenge of resources. It's resources, resources, resources.
And President Seligman is going to be on this program on Monday, if I recall correctly. I have to check my calendar. I'll check with my producer when I get off the program. But President Seligman will be on this program, and there will be plenty to talk about. Everybody wants to talk about Collegetown, and I get it. That's a very exciting thing. But let me start to wrap the conversation here with this here. Melissa, when you work in the line of work that you have, and you have got access to these documents in history, how do you even make sure that you're organized enough to dive into a book like Our Work Has But Begun? I mean, Janice talked about just having reams and reams of letters and documents. I mean, the organization must be paramount.
Well, I think it's a constant effort, and a lot of the credit goes to my predecessors. So Nancy Martin, who was my immediate predecessor as archivist, and Carl Kabelak, who was before her. And really going back through the ages, every time we do a history, we haven't done that many, every time I find a question, it's based on the work and the research of our predecessors. So it is a daunting task to have all of that information.
But you've chosen, and for years and decades, it's been chosen to be preserved. And I'm so glad, and I've by now our listeners get bored of hearing me say how much I love letters, and I love the art of communication. And what you and your staff have done, just really remarkable. This is Hayward. Let's grab one. Oops. Sorry, look what I've done there. Look at the host. Hayward, is that you, Hayward? Last call of the hour. Go ahead, sir.
Hey, Evan, how's it going?
Very good. Thank you, sir. Go ahead.
I was hoping one of your experts might be able to help qualify some family history for me. My great-grandfather was the president and CEO of Eastman Kodak throughout the 1960s. And family legend has it that before George Eastman started Kodak, he was a teller at a local bank. I believe it was the Lincoln Rochester Savings Bank. And family history goes that he came to my grandfather, or great-grandfather, rather, and asked for a loan. He was given the money to start, and he wound up starting Kodak with that. My great-grandfather was paid back in Kodak stock. And I've long tried to seek the truth behind that, to see if that was, you know, just family history or revisionist history, or if that actually happened. And I wanted to know if you guys had any suggestions on where I could go to do some research on that.
Well, you could get in touch with me offline. My email is melissa.mead@rochester.edu. And we can give it a try. It might be that we'll point you toward the Eastman House, but let me know and we'll see what we can find.
Oh, that's really sweet of you. It's melissa.reed.
Mead, M-E-A-D, at rochester.edu. There you go.
Okay. Like the old honey-based.
Yes, like a mead wine. Very good. I hope that's helpful to you. And you were nodding at the story of the bank teller. I'm trying to remember.
Yes.
That's accurate,
there was a period
it?
Of time when he was a bank teller with Lincoln Alliance, I think it was called in those days. Yeah.
All right. Well, look, we've got to wrap our discussion. Our Work Has But Begun, A History of the University of Rochester, 1850 to 2005. It is available now at the Barnes & Noble at
Mount Hope and Elmwood Avenue.
Elmwood Avenue.
And Our Work Has But Begun is taken from a speech of our first president, Martin Brewer Anderson.
Do you want to, you've got 26 seconds. Do you want to add a little more context to that, Paul?
Yeah, I think, was it the inaugural address?
It's his inaugural address in 1854.
He didn't come to the presidency until 1853. We were founded in 1850, but we didn't get a president until 1853, and it was Martin Brewer Anderson. And he ended his inaugural address with the words, "Our work has but begun." And so we'd like to think that we're carrying the tradition of our first president into the 21st century.
Never rest. But, you know, these problems, like I said this hour here, how fascinating that the differences in the way the challenges faced by each president. I love the way Janice broke down the book Among the Eight. Frankly, the challenges of success are good problems to have. So, Paul, thank you so much. Paul Burgett is the university vice president and the author of the books Afterward. Thank you for sharing your expertise with us. And also Melissa Mead, Rochester Collections librarian. Thank
and
you
university
well.
Archivist.
And a university archivist as well. Thank you. Thank you so much for being here, to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Evan. This is great fun.
Thanks to Janice as well. And thank you for listening to member-supported public radio. It's Pledge Week.